Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
On this episode of the Indie Opera Podcast, Noah and I sit down for a discussion with Royce Vavrick and Missy Mazzoli about their new collaboration called Song from the Uproar.
I mean, I've always been interested in using, you know, glissandos, and I use it in a lot of my work as a way of bringing dissonance. At one end of the bend, you have a very consonant chord. At the other end, you have a very consonant chord, but you have this in the middle, which is completely chromatic and dissonant.
We also are joined by our guest host, Brooke Larimer, who is joining us from Boston. And for the first time, we have an Indie Opera contest. Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
And this is Noah.
And I'm Brooke.
Who's that?
Who's Brooke?
There's a Brooke? Welcome, Brooke.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Brooke is connecting with us from the Boston area.
Yes, that's true.
It's a bi-state podcast this time.
So usually what we do is we talk about what we've seen. Have you seen anything recently, Brooke, that you'd like to talk about?
I think the thing that I saw most recently was BLO's production of Macbeth, which was great. Wow. You know, Macbeth is tough because the music doesn't really go with the story. So it's a challenge, I think, to produce. They kind of went more with a kind of dark, well, I mean, it's always dark, but it was very dark and kind of modern, and I really liked it. It was very visually striking and some great singing, and it was great.
Do you think the music is just kind of too sunny for the subject or for the story and for the...
Well, you know, it's kind of earlier Verdi, so, you know, it's a little like Oompa for Macbeth, which is really not Oompa. And so, you know, it's hard to kind of... And I love Shakespeare, so it's hard to kind of make the music make sense with the play, I think. And so, you know, I think it's difficult for... That's a challenge for any director, I would think. I mean, I am not a director, but it would be a challenge for me to sing that music and have it make sense with the characters that are being portrayed.
And we should say that Brooke is a wonderful performer, singer.
Oh, yeah. Well, something like that.
Mezzo-soprano.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know anything about Opera Boston, so tell us first... You know, what is Opera Boston in the whole scene? It's not the main opera company in Boston. It's sort of the number two, right?
Yeah, so Opera Boston and Boston Lyric Opera are the two primary opera companies. I guess I would say that Opera Boston is like the New York City opera as BLO is to the Met.
Right.
However, BLO is not nearly as big as the Met. It's not a repertory company. It does, you know, four shows a year or so, some additional outreach and whatnot. And where Opera Boston did three shows a year, and again, additional outreach and whatnot. So I believe that BLO is a B-level company by the Musical America standards, and that Opera Boston was a C-level company.
Okay, and so they're basically going defunct, and
basically what happened is the board determined that there was an insurmountable debt that they were facing if they produced the Midsummer Marriage, and decided that it was better to shut the whole company down than to try to rework the season or, you know, any number of other options. They just had decided that the best thing to do was to shut down.
So that means they're just going to cancel all their contracts and everything. It's over.
It's over, yes.
Wow. And is that affecting the... I mean, is that good news for small company, other companies, or is that bad news for opera all over the Boston area?
You know, I think it's bad for Boston. It certainly reflects poorly on the city. The mayor's office was very upset when they heard about it because there was no... They were not aware of that happening. They were not aware of the possibility of this problem. Certainly, there were hundreds of people who are out of work, either permanent or contract work. And that also is not great. And it, you know, basically takes Boston from a two opera company town to a one opera company town. Now, there are many, many other small opera companies in Boston that are doing great work. But these were the two primary professional, consistently high quality companies. And, you know, now one of them is kind of suddenly gone.
Should we talk about... See, now I'm afraid to talk about this.
What?
City Opera.
What do you mean?
Did you read the New York Times?
No. Why? What happened today? Something happened?
Not today, but a couple of days ago.
What happened?
There's no way there's going to be a season at City Opera this year. I mean, that's just...
Oh, yeah. Everybody said that, no?
Not until everything completely broke down with the unions this week.
Oh, no. I didn't see this.
Yes, I don't know. I mean, I really...
I had only heard... Last thing I heard about anything with opera was the... Enchanted Baroque pastiche, which I thought was kind of like, okay.
I really want to, I mean, I want to see Rufus Wainwright's opera. I don't care if it's good or bad. Yeah,
me too, but don't do it there. It's going to be bad, but don't do it there. Do it someplace small. I think it's going to be, I don't know. I just think it's not.
They're doing it at BAM, with City Opera's doing it at BAM. Or
well, that sounds like a better venue for it, but I have very low expectations for it. I might be surprised, but I feel like he's a songwriter, and like so many songwriters fail at opera, writing opera.
Have you heard any of it?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it's songwriter writing an opera to me.
I heard one aria, and I was like, this is like a very nice Rufus Wainwright song. Be a better song.
Really? The part I listened to, I said, this would sound better if it sounded more like Rufus Wainwright.
Well, I would definitely go see it. I would go see it with you.
For sure. I'm dying to see it. I mean, you know my opinion about Rufus Wainwright.
No, I don't know if you like him or not.
I do like him. I think that this opera that he wrote was the chance for like that crossover thing that really could have done a lot for opera.
Mm.
So I'm probably not going to put this all on the podcast because it's sellable. I haven't heard it yet.
That's the thing, but that's, you know, like, but that's why the podcast is useful. You have to stop thinking about it in terms of like, it's like firm. I mean, right? Because we can think now and then what if we're surprised? What if we confirm that we think it sucks or I think it might suck, you know? I mean, dude, if we see this thing and I think it's great and I'm like moved, I'll come back and eat my words.
All right.
Definitely.
But you have to stop swearing.
Oh, am I swearing all the time?
You are. I have to keep taking sentences out.
I swear. Okay, I'll watch it. I'm sorry.
I tried to find a beep sound.
Right.
It's not as easy as you would think.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be real easy. I just drop in a beep.
Also, I'm looking at a synopsis right now, man. It just looks like bull.
You know, he has this very classic idea of what an opera is. It's like the timeline of opera development stopped. He was a little kid, he was very big into like Tosca and Boheme. He would sing all the parts with his friends, and he has a very what shall we say, Toscanini classical.
No, you're totally right, and that's what makes me think that this opera is like a weird little dollhouse that he's making for himself, like a little kind of Michael Jackson. I'm gonna bring up a piece of my childhood and kind of idealize it and then control it with adult skill. And it's weird. It's like dandyism, don't you think?
Well, it's I that's why I'm kind of fascinated with it.
And yeah, I know. But
it could be something really. I mean, have you seen the movie The Artist?
No, I haven't. I want to.
It's taking this idea of the silent movie and it sort of does a modern thing with those constraints. And that's right. That's what an opera could be for if he wrote it. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. No, I mean, the could be element is what would make me want to see it. Like, because we know that this man is a really great musician.
Yeah.
He's brilliant. And he's a great songwriter and he understands drama and he understands storytelling. And so can he write an opera is the question, but you know what? so could Wolf and so could Schubert, and neither of those guys could bang out an opera that anybody performs anymore.
Oh, that's true too.
And that's the kind of sad, but
Beethoven gave a swing at it, and
I love that thing.
Do you like Fidelio?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a big mess, though.
It's a total mess.
I
like listening to it.
Yeah. Oh, it's a mystery. I mean, it's a weird opera, right? I mean, it's first off, it's a reverse rescue opera. That's really weird. Why is a woman? And then this, all of the cross-dressing and the kind of gender it's really strange, I think. It's a great opera. I love Fidelio. But I mean, yeah, it's a mess. I mean, there's the stupid Das Gold, Das Gold. That's like, shoot me in the face. Like, why did someone put this weird patter cuckoo clock bull song? Oh, see, I can't stop,
you can't,
man.
You can't stop yourself, can you?
I can't stop.
But it's he loved what Mozart was doing. I mean, he's going back to that thing, but I don't think it was organic to his inner self, and so it comes off as a little plastic.
That's what's, for me, what's so fascinating about Beethoven is how much of a kind of Asperger's kind of person he was. Like, you know, he could never really have a really long-term relationship with any girl, because I feel like he just would, instead of like bringing them out to have a nice time or something, he'd just be like, I have the inner soul in the poetry of my heart, and they're like, get the hell away from me. And he kind of does that in his operas too, where he has like these moments that are kind of supposed to be like dramatic, but not as dramatic as he makes them. You know, like that whole dungeon scene is so overwrought. And it's great, but he can't do it with Das Gold, Das Gold. That's like, he just has these hits and misses, you know? He's ham-handed. He's like a big heteronormative He is. Like,
you're carrying it again.
Well, is okay. I was using it in the French sense.
It was foreign language.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh my God, how am I going to edit this?
Yeah, the parts we need, right? I didn't know everything. I didn't know this was like the sixth season of The Wire. Like,
oh my God.
Okay.
This is good stuff. Thank you. let's actually. Oh, did we lose you?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Oh,
sorry. It sounded like it dropped off. Have you seen anything else up there in Boston?
I saw, so Boston Opera Collaborative, instead of doing their normal fall show, they did this cool, they called Opera Goes to Hell thing for Halloween at Club Oberon, which is this, it's actually a really cool venue. It's like a performance venue that has like tables and alcohol, and so you can go and drink beer and watch opera or watch, you know, there's any number of things. It's sort of a nightclub, like performance space.
Sounds like Galapagos here.
Yeah.
I don't know Galapagos, but I will have to check it out. Nice. So it's cool. It's in like Harvard Square, and so it's a great location and great venue. And they did scenes from operas, and then I want to say that they premiered, although I'm not 100% sure, they premiered an opera, a one-act opera by composer Frank Pesci. And it was about like a bunch of people who were in an insane asylum. It was the story where the guy like he shows up in an insane asylum and he thinks he's talking to the doctors, and then it becomes clear that actually the people who are running the establishment are actually the crazy people, and the people who are locked up are the same people. Actually, it was very entertaining. It was well performed, and it was a great venue for something like that. So that was cool. Boston Opera Collaborative does a lot of, I mean, their mission is to kind of give opportunities to young singers, and so it's you get to see a lot of kind of up and coming artists, and that's cool.
Great.
So now you said there was some news you guys wanted to talk about, some chatter. Who was that?
Oh, but first thing we should talk about is yeah, the mezzo soprano Wendy White. She fell from a platform. She fell 8 feet. during a performance of Gounod's Faust at the Met. Yeah, she was taken to the hospital, and she was not seriously injured. And so I guess she's stable, and they released her. But, you know, I think it seems like it's uncommonly frequent in opera, even today, like even the super hyper safe standards of today, to have these kind of things, right? Like falls and slips and ankle breakings and ankle twistings and, you know.
Well, it's opera's not for wimps.
Opera's not for wimps. And 8 feet, 8 feet's a drop.
Yeah, that's bad.
Didn't someone else fall from a ladder? And
yes, there was a tenor. I don't remember his name, but I had a professor in grad school who saw this actually happen. It was in the opera by Janáček, the Makropoulos case, that's, or the Makropoulos right. case. Yeah. And so anyway, there's a huge, it was at the Met, and it was a huge ladder in the middle of the stage, and he had a heart attack at the top and fell. Yeah, he was like a big
That's horrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'd be scarred for life if I saw something like that.
Yeah. Ladders, I guess, are not a good idea in opera. We'll just put that out there.
Oh, here it is. Okay, a hinge on a piece of plywood that connected the platform to the stairway broke, causing the plywood to give way and leading to the fall.
Oh, horrible.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if anyone who's listening to the show has not actually produced an opera, especially an opera house where you're doing rep, we have to set up a new opera every... I mean, Saturday they have to set up two operas, right? Very quickly.
Yeah.
So it can be very, very dangerous on the stage.
Yeah.
Yes.
Other chat items?
Well, I found... two things. Have we talked about this group Encompass New Opera Theater in Brooklyn at all?
I have mentioned them.
Okay, and they have two things coming up. One in February, which is kind of vague, but it just says music for the soul and mind, and it's a bunch of music by new composers, Charles Fussell, Evan Mack, and Daniel Schlossberg. And the only composer out of that group that I've heard of is Evan Mack. But
I actually went to college with Evan Mack. Isn't that funny?
Where did you go again, to undergrad?
Vanderbilt University.
Vanderbilt, okay, so Blair School of Music.
Yep.
And Encompass is a really cool little theater. It's run by Nancy Rhodes, mm-hmm. who is a force of nature, let's say.
She
is.
There's always those kinds of people in opera, but yeah.
Oh, she's amazing, and she's brilliant, I would say. And she puts a lot of effort into making productions that are approachable for the audience and innovative, and she's very open-minded. I like her a lot.
Cool. So that concert, Music for the Soul and Mind, is February 5th, 2012, yep. Sunday at 4 p.m. And then the other thing is the thing right below it. It's on their website. This opera called The Astronaut's Tale.
Okay.
So it's in collaboration with Opera Index and Manhattan School of Music, and it's an opera about a young man struggling to become an astronaut. And I just think that you have to see an opera about an astronaut, right, eventually. So here it is. And a music by Charles Fussell and libretto by Jack Larson, and that's March 18th, 2012. It's also a Sunday, and it's at Manhattan School of Music in the Greenfield.
What did I know Jack
Larson.
You're
thinking of Libby Larson.
No, there's a Jack Larson. He did the Virgil Thompson.
Mother of Us All.
No. Lord Byron. He's also... I think he's the guy, believe it or not, who played Jimmy Olsen in The Adventures of Superman. I think that's Jack Larson.
Really?
You don't believe me.
Hold on. No, I do. Hold on a second. Superman.
Yes.
So he's doing an opera libretto.
Well, he did. I mean, he worked with Virgil Thompson on the Lord Byron, which was, I mean, that was a while ago.
Wow.
But yeah, no, he's pretty interesting to cross over from TV to writing for opera.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, there's been opera for TV. You know, A Mall and the Night Visitors was a TV opera.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. I have one more thing. So the Center for Contemporary Opera is having a reading of libretti, and it's called Prima le Parole, and it's February 5th, 6:30 p.m., and it's on the east side. New York Society Library, 53 East 79th Street, just east of Madison Avenue. And they're reading libretti, which is kind of interesting. There's one called, this is the one that caught my eye, The Human Zoo.
All right.
Which is about a group of human oddities that are not, in fact, human oddities, but are exhibited as if they were. So that sounds interesting, and I might try to check that out.
That actually sounds great. Yeah. I sang with them last January, and I really liked working with them. It's a cool little company. I don't know if you've seen I did a staged reading of the first act of Enemies, A Love Story by Ben Moore. As his showed him all the signs and wonders that blaze in the sky. Father says, God set. Have you guys read that book or seen the movie or anything like that?
Mm-mm.
Oh.
So the story is written by Isaac Singer, and it's about a story about a guy who survives the Holocaust and comes to New York to discover that he has three living wives. So it's a kind of a Woody Allen character. He's really neurotic. It's great. And they made a movie a few years ago, and Angelica Houston plays one of the wives, and it's really fabulous. And then Ben Moore has been writing this opera on the story. It was really fun, and that's a really kind of cool company. They do cool stuff, and Jim Schaefer, the guy who runs it, is really great, mm-hmm. really upbeat, and really into new music. And
cool, so, that's great.
Yeah,
It's a big, you know, big web here.
So now I'm going to put out a little mention of this one. It's actually, I don't know if I can include it or not, because it might actually change our rating from PG to something else. But there is
Are we PG rated, Peter?
Why? Because I know my dear friend Allie, who's listening in Maine, who's in, junior high? And all my great young listeners. We have young listeners.
Okay.
But there's a porn opera.
Whoa.
That's coming up. I know. It's the performances are March 2nd. It's by a really wonderful composer, actually, named Gordon Bieferman. And it's being directed by Beth Greenberg. I don't know if you know her, but she used to direct at City Opera. Maybe she still is. And it's called The Enchanted Organ, a Porn Opera. I know. I know, isn't it? Anyway, but if people are interested, I will post something on our website.
I don't think that should change our rating.
We'll see.
Okay.
So anything else?
Nothing for me either.
Some of the bigger events that are coming up. Opera Company of Philadelphia is doing Elegy for Young Lovers by Hans Werner Henze. Do you know it?
I do. No. I've heard music from it. I think that Henze is going to have a big resurgence in this country in the next 50 years or so, because he's like a major composer that people don't know at all in this country.
And that's coming at March 14th through 18th. Now, Opera Company of Philadelphia, we've mentioned before, because they're also in June, they're going to be doing the Dark Sisters that we mentioned earlier.
It could be because he's a gay communist. It could be that. I'm just saying. I'm throwing it out there.
Right. Political unrest and all that.
You know, or just the combo, really.
It's good.
Excellent. Other operas that you might know, The Ballad of Baby Doe is being done by Opera Idaho in April. I heard a ugh.
No, I didn't do that.
I've never actually seen that opera performed. I've only heard like the arias.
I don't know.
What?
I hate that opera.
Uh-oh.
it's like All My Children, the opera.
Right.
It's bad.
I mean,
I don't know. People love it, but it's... I don't know. I don't get
it. Who loves it?
People who love Americana and people who think it's a kind of triumph in American composing love it. And people who love Beverly Sills singing high notes love it. And that's a lot of people.
Yeah, she did. She did a very famous performance. Also, Elizabeth Futrelle's performed it. Karen Armstrong.
Karen Armstrong's great.
And that's coming up in April. And we should say it's by Douglas Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And Manhattan School is also doing The Ghost of Versailles.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which I think is really interesting. I saw the production at the Met. It's really a big production. And
I was going to say, how are they going to do that? That's a huge show.
That's a good question.
Seeing just for that.
Yeah. And let's see, other really cool opera companies. The Canadian Opera Company, we mentioned that Caïja Sarajevo, L'Amour de Loin, They're also going to be doing the Zemlinsky, a Florentine tragedy.
I don't know that. Yeah. I'd like to know that.
It's great. I'll throw some music in on this one. I have that CD. They're performing it with Johnny Skeeky because they're both little short things.
Cool.
Excellent.
And that's coming up in April, May, etc. Let's see. I know we've talked about Jake Heggie before, and actually next year is going to be a big year for him. Not only is Calgary Opera doing the Moby Dick, like we said, San Diego Opera is doing it too in February, and Tulsa Opera is doing his Dead Man Walking in February. So this guy's getting a lot of his work done, and they're also doing three Decembers of his at Fort Worth Opera.
Is that an opera, Three Decembers?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with that one.
It's a chamber opera.
Okay.
Oh, great. Okay. Do you know what it's about?
An aging Broadway star named Madeline and her adult children, Charlie and Beg, brave the depths of memory, love, and resentment.
Wow. That could be good.
Could be like Anti-Mame.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like a few musicals that I know, actually.
Yeah.
And then there's also, do you know Mark Adamo's Lysistrata?
Yeah, I do.
They're doing that in Fort Worth in May and June. So maybe let's see if we can get him on the show.
I would love to talk with Mark Adamo. I'd like to hear that opera again, too. I saw it at City Opera, and it's an interesting work. It's like something I wish I knew the play a lot better before I went to go see it.
Men are guilty of sacrilege, trespass. Their poach is led by a jackass. They're fearless, furious,
you know, because it's pretty complicated, but awesome.
How does it compare to Little Women?
Well, let's see. I think it's a different, completely different story, and it's a Greek story, and you know, it's Aristophanes, and I think that I remember it being louder and a little bit more pulse-driven and a little bit more grand scale. You know, where Little Women is about these kind of very fine details and runs and things like that. You know, so I think I only saw it once, so that's kind of why I want to see it again, or hear it again at least.
Sure.
Well, maybe we have a rich patron who can fly us out to Fort Worth.
Yeah, maybe one named Gertrude or something like that.
So we interviewed Missy Mazzoli, who was recently deemed one of the more consistently inventive and surprising composers now working in New York by the New York Times. And she was called Brooklyn's post-millennial Mozart by Time Out New York. Her music has been performed all around the world by Kronos Quartet, the Minnesota Orchestra, New York City Opera, and Eighth Blackbird, among others. She is currently working on commissions from the Albany Symphony, the Detroit Symphony, and cellist Maya Beiser, and has been touring regularly with her ensemble, Victoire. Actually, I like the clips you're going to hear in this. It's interesting how she deals with dissonance, and she seems to be crossing the boundary between like classical composition and rock, and she uses electric guitar. And
yeah, it's even more that she doesn't even recognize a boundary, right? It's like we never heard her say things like, I like to bring in rock influences or rock. She just says things like, I want an electric guitar.
Yeah.
I want, you know, she's a interesting composer.
So we sat down and we took some Cuban food. We went, we took out some Cuban food and sat down. There were four of us, Noah and I and Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavrick. Royce Vavrick we've interviewed before. He's that amazing librettist who's doing work everywhere.
He is busy. Both of them are super busy, which is great. It's great to see musicians and librettists busy during a recession.
And this is a production that's going to be done at the Kitchen coming up this spring. So let's listen to that.
Thank you.
Okay, we're here with Missy Mazzoli and with Royce Vavrick. We've actually spoken to Royce Vavrick before. Missy Mazzoli is an amazing composer who composed Song from the Uproar, which will be playing at The Kitchen February 24th through March 3rd. And it's actually an opera about Isabel Eberhardt, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Isabel Eberhardt was a really interesting character. So how did you find out about her?
I found out about her randomly. Someone mentioned her name on NPR and as part of a list of female explorers. And her name, out of everybody else's, really stood out to me for some reason. And I just kept it in my head for years and then was... randomly kind of looked it up on Wikipedia and immediately knew that this was my first opera.
It seems that Wikipedia has been an inspiration for a lot of operas.
I'm so happy to hear that it's not just me.
No, it's not just you.
I mean, you know, I wouldn't construct a libretto completely from Wikipedia, but I know you don't do that either.
No.
It's just as a way to, like, instantly see a lot of facts and ideas.
It was Wikipedia amazing. Wikipedia is like a way of thinking. It's not even like a... Yeah, it's the... And you know, the thing is, academics hate Wikipedia, which means you know it's good.
It has its place.
Yeah, that's right.
So the idea to do this opera, were you approached first by someone say, I would like to commission you to do this opera, or is this an opera that floated around your head for a while?
It was, you know, from my own head. I started it in 2008, and I wrote, you know, half an hour of music that we then produced ourselves, myself along with the filmmaker Stephen Taylor. We produced it at Galapagos. And once that was sort of a success, we thought, yes, okay, now this has to be... The real vision for this piece is a 70, 75-minute opera.
And at what point did you get Royce involved?
It was at that point, after the Galapagos production. I had written the libretto for this 30-minute segment. And then to expand it, I wanted to bring on somebody who knew what they were doing a little more. I called Royce.
Have you worked with him before? Or?
No, this is our first collaboration.
And how did you hear about Royce?
Royce has worked with my friend David Little. That's how I first heard about him. I saw a part of Dog Days that they did at Carnegie Hall and was like, yes, this language is so... accessible kind of sounds like a bad word, but it was. It was just, I could hear everything that the singers were saying. It was interesting. It was quirky. It was funny. And I thought, that's what I want. Even though my opera is about the furthest thing from Dog Days, I thought, this is someone who I think I can work with.
So now it's an opera with video.
Mm-hmm.
Does it tell a narrative story or is it just sort of vignettes? How does that work?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, it's essentially Isabel Eberhard at the moment of her death. You know, she died when she was very young. She was 27. She died in a flash flood in the desert. And the whole opera is her looking back at significant moments in her life. So it's told in chronological order. And there's sort of a couple of narratives that emerge out of all these different scenes. She was born in Switzerland and moved to North Africa when she was 19. She falls in love with an Algerian soldier, and they have this on-again, off-again, very interesting relationship. She joins a Sufi cult. Her whole family passes away soon before she leaves for North Africa, so we see her sort of grieving them and then making the decision to leave. We see her traveling to North Africa. So it is sort of kind of, we're always in this dream state of this woman who's dead and who's remembering her life in flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not always completely accurately. I mean, there's sort of these fantastic costumes and these sort of dreamy films and these anachronistic scenes, and especially in the film, but also in the music itself and in the words.
Did you take musical examples from the Northern African area and work it into your work, or what was the inspiration musical for you?
No, I didn't do that on purpose. I thought about doing that, but it was sort of too on the nose. You know, I really was much more interested in the connections between Isabel Eberhardt and the modern world. So, like, women alive in the 21st century, myself included, you know, as a starting point, how do I connect to her story? And just sort of the emotional landscape of her story. She was a very passionate, dramatic woman. And actually, most of the libretto comes out of her journals. Some lines are things that she actually said that we turned, Royce and I turned into something that was more singable.
It seems that from what I've heard of your music, but when I was hearing it, I was sort of reminded of archaeology. Seems like your music has layers and layers at the same time, and then it's sort of a modern examination of an older layer, the sort of different layers of traditions that come through.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that one of the really interesting things about Isabel Eberhardt is that we don't know a lot about her. When she died, you know, a lot of her writing was washed away in the flood that killed her. And so her husband had to come and pull out her writing. They dried it off in these big urns. And then later on, they were published, you know. So she left behind, you know, 5 volumes of a journal, a bunch of short stories, and I think an unfinished novel.
Is any part of that in the opera? Or is there, do we see any part of the...
The flood?
The drying in the furnace.
You will see some of the journals. You'll see some of the papers. You'll see a lot of the flood, and water plays a big part in the opera, which is interesting because it all takes place in a desert.
But how did you decide 60 to 75 minutes?
I wanted a solid evening length work with no intermission because I'm interested in my work in creating worlds for the audience to step into. You know, I don't want people to feel like they're watching something. I want them to feel like they're immersed in this world of Isabel Eberhard. Even the moment people walk into the kitchen, I feel like we're going to do things to make people feel like they are instantly in that world.
The clips I saw on the website were for one singer and, mm-hmm. and chamber group. Is there a larger cast than that?
Yes. So there's still one lead. Isabel Eberhard is played by Abigail Fisher. And there is a 5-person chorus who also sing from Isabel's point of view. The whole libretto is told from Isabel's point of view, but they're sort of her subconscious. You know, they're extrapolating and
I always use a word that the libretto is essentially a big extrapolation on her ideas and things that she published, especially in her journals that were available to us.
Well, initially, I wrote text for 5 sections, really short poems, basically, that were inspired by lines in her journal, and then wrote the music, and then the video comes afterwards. And then Royce came along and wrote the text for the remaining section, and then we sort of created this web of things, mixing the old and new material. But it's mostly Royce.
Do you
About
write?
70% Royce.
Have you always written, or
you know,
did you write
no.
for this?
But I was trying to find a way into the text for this opera, and I was looking at old, you know, Persian poetry, I was looking at, you know, Arabic poetry, looking at old songs, and talking to different writers and librettists and friends who are writers, and I just was like, I need to do this myself. And I feel like I understand this woman's story better than anybody else I've ever met, and I'm just not going to be happy with the work that anyone else would do. And Royce is different because we did a lot of research together, and I feel like he definitely gets it.
Well, I also had the benefit of hearing the material you came up with, so I knew not only the language that you were excited about, and I learned a lot about your musical language through this piece, and also going further, knew about your what excited you and how you were going to approach this piece musically. Mm-hmm. So I was able to tailor the libretto to what I knew that was pre-existing.
We'd done a bunch of workshops over the last 3 years since I started in 2008. We did, we were part of Vox and New York City Opera, mm-hmm. and for that one, I had to orchestrate sort of these initial sections that I wrote without Royce for orchestra, and I thought, this is going to be awesome, it's really going to come to life, it's going to be so alive, and we're going to have this chorus, and it's going to be great, and it was great, but I think it flattened it out a little more than I expected. I think there's something really visceral and personal about having just the 5-person ensemble, the one singer playing Isabel, and then everything sort of coming out of this one woman's journey, because she was so isolated and so alone. That I think we lost a lot of that when we filled the stage with people.
It became grand.
Yeah, it became this grand thing, and it was like, good, but it's not quite as alive for me. From the beginning, wanted to work with Now Ensemble, which is a New York-based 5-piece ensemble. It's flute, clarinet, guitar, piano, and double bass. And there's also electronics throughout the work, too.
It seems like there's a trend right now that people are not interested in writing the next grand opera, right? The next big spectacle thing. It seems like people are really drawn towards chamber ensembles and chamber orchestras and chamber works.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to separate it from the economy, too. I mean, who is going to invite me to write? You know, if anyone would like to invite me to write a huge grand opera, I'm your woman. Just to put that out there. I will do it. But really, you know, if when I was thinking about starting this project myself, the idea of hiring an orchestra, forget about it, you know? Having, like, 12 singers? No way.
And when did electronics enter the picture for you?
You know, I started about 5 years ago working with electronics, and it was just this really... I work a lot with voices, so you have these disembodied voices that are processed and chopped up into little pieces, and in the opera you'll hear some ambient sounds, like sounds of water, sounds of boats, but really it's a lot of recordings of the chorus that are multiplied and layered, or recordings of the soloist Abby Fisher. Mm-hmm. So it just creates this like dreamy world that without really a source, it's sort of coming from everywhere on stage.
Right.
Do you have a bit of it here that we can listen to?
Sure.
On the Victrola.
On the Victrola. Interesting. I mean, the first thing I thought of when I heard that was the Muslim call to prayer. I mean, in Morocco, you hear that overlapping and sort of the pitches crossing.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in using, you know, glissandos, and I use it in a lot of my work as a way of bringing in dissonance. Mm-hmm. At one end of the bend, you have a very consonant chord. At the other end, you have a very consonant chord. But you have this in the middle, which is completely chromatic and dissonant. So when you layer a bunch of them on top of each other, it's an interesting way of creating more interesting harmony out of very simple harmony.
What is happening at this point in the...
So this is towards the end. We start the opera with her death, and she flashes back to very significant moments in her life, and we follow her all the way back to her death. And she's sort of... Isabel has gone through a lot. I mean, she had a very difficult life. You know, her husband has left her. Her family is dead. Even religion at this point is not a solace for her because she's such a passionate, emotional person. And to have people say to her, one point in the opera, everyone around her is saying, "It is written, it is written," you know, implying, like, why do you feel this way? Why do you feel so devastated? when Allah says this is written and there's nothing you can do about it. And she rejects it at that point, but still manages to find solace in through her writing and really through herself in the end.
So she converted to being a Muslim, right?
Yes.
And then she became a Sufi, and a Sufi is just an unusual sect of the Muslim faith. It's a very meditative sect, and a lot of people may know it from the sort of the spinning and the slow.
They're ascetics, right? They don't...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone apparently tried to assassinate her?
Yes, she... well, what happened was this man from a rival sect tried to behead her in a courtyard. You know, so there's actually a scene from the opera where we show this. You know, she's leaning over a desk. She's translating a letter for somebody. This man comes out of nowhere with a sword and tries to bring it down on her head. It was a really devastating thing for her. But did I answer the question or...
I have no idea. It doesn't matter.
She went to trial.
She did go to trial and
ended up defending him.
Yeah.
You know, because they were going to sentence him to death. And she said, that's too harsh. You know, this is not keeping with my faith. I think he got like a life's worth of hard labor or something.
She was living as a man?
She was. Yeah. She dressed as a man for most of her life. Even as a child, her father would dress her as a boy. And then when she moved to North Africa, it was kind of a convenient thing where she would roam around on horseback dressed as a man. But it also fit with her personality that she could not really live as a Muslim woman. It was too restrictive. She could be really free as a Muslim man, and everyone accepted her as a man, even though they kind of knew that she was a woman.
Was that a motivation, though, with this guy?
It sounds like that in Albania or something, there's like, there are...
Yeah.
Am I...
So a little bit about it. I mean, you know, there's a tradition in Albania when, since a lot of the men in these small villages were killed in the war, that women would take over the role of a man, you know, so they'll decide at a young age to live as the man in the family. So it's similar, sort of different to Isabel's story, but fascinating.
How much of her writing was about her relationship to religion or to...
I mean, it's sort of peppered throughout her diaries. Maybe
it's pretty dire stuff. It's pretty
like what?
The quality is really, really fascinating because she was a very... she seems somewhat, you know, depressed or almost bipolar in a weird way. Like there are moments of deep, deep, deep sadness, and then a few moments of fleeding joy.
So Royce, you want to read a tidbit for us?
These days, so full of sorrow, anguish, and uncertainty, have made me realize just how much I love this part of the world. The loss of this land will be a bitter one. And then later, I must make a huge effort to get through this week without giving into depression and put the time to good use, which is the hardest part.
So would you say her struggles are more of circumstance or of, is it more of an inner struggle, her life? It sounds like it's external.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think the thing about her, again, the fascinating thing about Isabel Everhart is that we don't know about her, much about her at all. We only know sort of what she told us about herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a day and age when everyone knows everything about everybody,
right. She's
an amazingly attractive figure for an opera because I can sort of superimpose my own ideas, our own ideas on it.
Mm-hmm. So there are no other sources other than her writings? Did anyone else write about her? Mm-hmm.
This is basically it. And this is not even her. This is someone else. There's The Oblivion Seekers, which is her book of short stories. I'm holding up books to the microphone for all of you out there. We have Isabel, The Life of Isabel Everhard, written by Annette Kobach, which is a great book. Mm-hmm. And then her journals.
Which is titled The Nomad.
And see, I can hold it all in one hand. You can read it all in one day. I mean, it's amazing.
This is crazy. Yeah.
But I think her thing is that she had a really tragic life. And then just living in a very turbulent time. You know, she's a sort of French-speaking woman who's in this colony, and there's a lot of fighting, and it's a very kind of not a very settled place. But she, throughout all that, is committed to finding her true self.
So you see her as a hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do. I get tremendous inspiration from her.
Should we play an example of what the chorus sounds like?
Sure. Why don't you talk about what's going on in Capsized Heart?
So Capsized Heart is she references the deaths in her family. And there is a motif that happens throughout the opera where a gun is introduced. So this is actually a coda to a big number, a big sort of set piece of the whole opera.
And this is the first time when you get the chorus as a whole.
Do you?
feel about the way that a classically trained voice sounds? Do you ever want other sounds? How do you deal with that?
For me, for someone for whom harmony is such an important part of my work, I gravitate towards singers who have a straighter tone or can have the option of going in that direction. Right. I mean, Abby Fisher is a perfect example in that she has sung a lot of early music, but also can sing Wagner and, you know, and Verdi, and is a really versatile voice. So I'm not going to say that I want singers who don't have any vibrato, because that's too extreme, but I like people who can also sing pop music. You know, it's sort of have to be able to do everything.
It seems that a lot of the new younger singers are much more flexible now anyway. I mean, don't you think they're more experimental?
Yeah, no, I think so. Because I think that the kind of music that's going on nowadays is, if you're going to be somebody who sings new music, you're going to be somebody who's willing to and used to accommodating composers. You know, and gone are the days where you could say, you know, like, listen, I do what I do and you do what you do.
So tell me a little bit more about the team you're working with on this project.
Well, we have an amazing director, Gia Farakis, who has been instrumental from the beginning, actually, in helping us organize the dramatic flow of the piece.
She's been very dramaturgically involved.
Mm-hmm. And now is starting to begin the staging process. The whole thing is fully staged.
She has created this method of gestural work. It's called One Thought, One Action, and she's actually going to implement it on these singers who are not... she has a company, these people who are really awesome at doing it. So she's now giving the tools to these singers to create a very gestural work of opera theater, which is super fascinating. And we had a workshop this past summer where we got to watch her give the actors those tools, and it was really, 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 really cool.
It's sort of something between, it's like Robert Wilson meets dance meets something else.
Has everyone in the cast warmed up to it? Everyone seems
Yeah, I mean, we had an extensive workshop process, so people were introduced to this technique really early on.
Okay.
And it's different from a regular opera in that these singers we're asking them to immerse themselves in this theatrical acting movement technique and sing.
Yeah.
It's something completely new.
Tell me a little bit about the videographer, the video maker.
Mm-hmm. His name is Stephen Taylor, and he has been involved in this from the beginning. It was really Steve and I who started the project, and there will be film throughout most of the opera. Steve does this amazing thing where he goes frame by frame to these films and erases people from them. So you get be watching this, what looks like an old home movie, and then gradually someone in the picture will just fade away, you know? And this has obvious sort of layers of meaning that apply to an opera where Isabel's family has died, you know, and people are gradually fading from the picture, leaving only this little girl.
And he's really amazing. He's such a cool video artist in the sense that it really feels like he's creating a singular video language. Like, he did not go to Algeria and film 1,200 hours of footage. He is going into the archives and finding these really figurative images that evoke a feeling or a quality that is in the text and the music, and then creating a video component. But he's done, a sensational job of making it so it's not literal.
Who's the music director?
Steve Osgood.
Osgood. Great.
Will be conducting, and he's the music director. Beth Morrison is producing. Costumes are by Alexandra Englund, and set design is by Zane Pilstrom. Lighting is by Scott Bowman, and they're all part of this collective, as well as the director, they're all part of a collective called Wing Space, which creates these amazing theatrical productions. And they latched onto our idea of creating a dream world. You know, so the costumes have elements from the Victorian era where she was living, elements of North African costume, but nothing is really literal. And the set, same thing. You have like some, they look like Moroccan lanterns, but it's never quite on the nose. It's always very abstract and sort of timeless.
Tell us a little bit about where people can get more information about this.
Sure. Well, there's a website, songfromtheuproar.com. And tickets will go on sale really soon at The Kitchen, which is thekitchennyc.org.
Well, I'm excited to see this. I can't wait. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Great.
And thanks
for
the Cuban food.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun. It was fun. The food was good. The conversation was good. And I can't wait to see that piece.
Me too.
It's one of those mixes between, you know, with video, and music. And
I kept trying to, like, it sounds like, do you know the poet Rimbaud? He like, did all of his great work when he was 18 and 19, and then he moved to Morocco and died selling arms in Morocco when he was, like, 23.
It seemed like a trend, huh?
Like, I don't know what it is about Morocco that it just attracts really crazy people from rich families in Europe. You know?
Well, it's easy to get there from Spain because the boat goes right over. It's the closest, right. Isn't it? The closest point straight across.
Oh, you've been there, right?
Well, I never went. We didn't go that way. We did the modern way. We flew in.
Yeah.
So that would be fun to cross on the boat from Spain. So now.
Yeah, that's a loss.
we wanted to have a contest.
Yeah, contest.
So we're going to play a little snippet of music for one of our listeners to identify the composer and the particular opera that this comes from. And what is the prize going to be?
The prize will be that you get to choose between three opera DVDs from our collection. A choice between three.
What are they?
Do I have to tell? Do I have to say them? Well, that should be known to the prize winner, no?
No incentive.
No incentive? Three opera DVDs. That's clear enough, no?
Okay.
All right, we're going to play a segment of an opera. Mm-hmm. And the goal, I guess, is going to be to guess the opera and to tell us, what opera it is. Obviously, if you guess what opera it is, you'll know what composer it is, I guess, right?
Yeah, I feel like if you can tell... There's a lot of ways that you can get an end to this answer, right? Like you probably know the style,
right?
If you knew the style, you'd know this guy, you'd know that guy.
Right, so that's not too hard.
And horrible set of hints, but we just kind of think that you could.
And then what art song is referenced in this clip?
Yeah, that's a good.
How's that?
Additional little hint.
All right, so here it is.
Good stuff.
And
thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, Brooke. We'll have you on again.
I hope so.
And don't tell your friends the secret to the contest.
Oh, I have no intention. I will probably forget as soon as I get off the phone.
Excellent.
All right, man. Have a good night.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Got Stitcher? We are on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.